Matt Bell is the author of, and I love this title, In the House, Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and In the Woods, which just got a lot of good press and was a Michigan Notable Book Award, was a Choice Adult Debut Book of the Year. It just did fantastic. This is his next novel that we're going to talk about today, and it's called Scrapper. His writing has appeared in the Best American Mystery Stories, Tin House, The New York Times, Conjunctions, Golf Course, The American Reader, and many other publications. He was born in Michigan, and he now teaches creative writing at Arizona State University. Matt, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks so much for having me.
Matt, you and I have been Facebook friends for at least a couple of years now, but I've never actually met you in person.
Yeah, it's funny how that goes. I kind of feel the same way. Like, I've obviously seen you online a lot. I've read your book, you know, but it's weird to get to talking. Not in person, but
yeah,
it's very nice.
People hate on Facebook a lot, but the fact is, when you're a writer, it's a wonderful way to let your community know that you're, you know, what you're doing. I mean, I would not have known about this book hadn't I seen a post you put on Facebook.
Well, see, there you go.
Yeah.
I feel the same way, honestly. Like, I'm lucky now to be really plugged in with a lot of in-person writing communities. When I first started, if I hadn't had the internet, I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't have had anybody to talk to about any of this stuff.
Yeah, know? Yeah, it was tough. When my first two books came out, there was, you know, there was internet, there was email, but there really wasn't the social networking that there
right.
is now, and those books sold absolutely nothing. I didn't know how to do it, and I'm getting a little bit better
right.
at it. But Scrapper, man, this is a beautiful novel, and I'm glad I saw the Facebook post, because immediately I contacted your publisher or had our producer to get a copy of it, and I love this book. You know, one of the things that I always teach or try to emphasize with my student is that in a good work of fiction, the landscape, that is the setting, is fundamental to the entire meaning of the work,
mm-hmm.
that you can't take the setting out and just arbitrarily place it somewhere else. And this novel is set in Detroit, and if I'm not mistaken, kind of in the near future. The way you describe Detroit and just the landscape itself is so dark and desolate, and this novel has to take place in Detroit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in some ways, that's where it generated from, was from the setting. I had seen a really small documentary clip on the New York Times in, like, 2012 that was sort of about the metal scrapping in Detroit. It just, like, really struck something. It was really interesting mm-hmm. to me. I grew up in Michigan. I lived in Michigan my whole life until this past year. And that's where I started writing about, was I kind of got to know Kelly, the protagonist, not by inventing him in advance, but by moving him through this landscape, moving him through these empty buildings, these empty schools, these empty hospitals. These neighborhoods that have been sort of emptied out. And, you know, initially I didn't really know what his story was. And my goal was, like, just keep him acting, keep seeing the world through his eyes, you know? So, like, the setting in some way generated the person, if that makes sense.
It makes
the character
sense.
Grew out of it, yeah.
Yeah, and let's let our listeners know exactly what you mean by metal scrapping. What he does is, you know, whether you did it by intention or not, it's full of metaphorical possibilities.
Sure, yeah.
So what is metal scrapping?
Yeah, so
what does Kelly do?
Kelly has moved back to Michigan after some time living in the South. He's unable to find work in Detroit. And so he ends up metal scrapping, which is scavenging for steel and iron and copper and similar things. In mostly abandoned buildings, although initially in the book, I think there was some that there's other ways of doing that. And that's a big problem in Detroit. It's a big problem in a lot of cities. People are going into buildings and basically making them unusable by taking out all the piping or all the wiring. In some of the buildings I was in when I was researching, you know, structural metal had been taken out, right? The buildings were really unsafe. And yeah, and some of that stuff is worth very little. Some of it's worth a lot. Copper right now is really expensive. And so there's a lot of copper theft. So that's sort of the occupation he has, I guess, as the book is opening, is this sort of making his living off the abandonment of certain parts of the city.
It's this part of the city that he enters, you refer to as the zone. Everything's dilapidated, everything's abandoned. You know, I just love the possibility of what it could mean. And I'm not going to attach a singular meaning to any of your images,
sure.
because I think they're too powerful to do that. But I love when he goes into apartment buildings where families used to live, and he's just scraping out what's left, and it's very little. But that is just a fantastic setting. you know, it reflects so many things about this novel and, frankly, so many things about him in terms of his attempt to, shall we say, have a home.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
has been
absolutely
scraped, you know. It's fantastic, and it's completely organic. Publisher Weekly says that this novel has the feel of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, set in Motor City. And I would have to agree with that, because the landscape is, you know, very McCarthy-like, if you mm-hmm. if you look at The Road. Is he one of your influences?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a really big McCarthy fan. When I was writing my last novel, actually, I do this thing where every year I try to pick a writer and just read as much of them as I can.
Oh, that
and
makes
when
sense.
I was writing In the House upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods, my last novel, in the maybe second year of working that book or something, I read all of McCarthy. You know, and I'd read a lot of it before, but I made a concerted effort to do that. He's one of my favorite. And yeah, and I think the same way you were talking at the beginning of our discussion, landscape is so important to him. And that was something that took me a long time, I think, to learn as a writer. Like, I think my early stories take place, like, in white rooms in anonymous places, right?
Right, you know? Right.
And you know, at the time I thought maybe that there was a certain kind of strength to that, but I think both of my novels have been very landscape-driven in really different ways, and I think that's become something really important to me that wasn't in the past.
You said that you like to read writers. You go through these phases where you read a lot of the same writer. I think that's
yeah.
interesting advice. You know, I'm thinking of John Cleese. I know this sounds a little random, but
sure.
He does this wonderful craft talk on comedy. And he says, what you want to do is you want to watch the stand-up comedians over and over, the ones that you really admire, that really make you laugh.
Yeah.
Watch them over and over and over until you don't laugh anymore. Because it's when you don't laugh anymore that you start to see how things are shaped. And I would imagine it'd be the
really
same.
Like that.
Yeah, it'd be the same, I guess, with fiction. You know, when you're not entering the landscape anymore, you enter it over and over and over. But there comes a point where you're no longer entering it and you're seeing how it's built. And it makes a lot of sense, because your descriptions of Detroit are haunting. I felt like I'm there the entire time. Talk about the vivid and continuous dream where you enter into a story and you think you're there. You've certainly created that. And along with it is you build it through language, through voice, through,
mm-hmm.
through rhythm. And McCarthy does that too, although I would say your voice is not McCarthy.
Sure, yeah. No, I don't think so either. But yeah, similar tactics maybe. And definitely, I care a lot about the acoustics of language. I read a lot as I'm writing. I really think that, just like in music, where like you can listen to a song that's in a language you don't even know, and the vocals can be really evocative. The sound and the rhythm is like one of the instruments you're playing as a writer. And I think that you can do a lot of the evoking and emotional sort of landscape of a book at that level, like even before the content, like that person reading this book is going to feel some of that dread and desolation and isolation, because built into the language of the book, it's not, I don't have to tell you it exists, you should be able to hear it, you know, even if you never hear it out loud, but you hear it in your head.
Matt Bell does not write sentences, he writes spells. Benjamin Percy wrote that about your prose, and I have to agree, the language is quite frankly beautiful, and it really does bring you into a trance. It brings you into this landscape. But quickly, I want to go back to the idea of setting. I want to compare Detroit, especially the way you depict it in this novel, and really kind of the image that people who aren't from Detroit have of it. I want to compare it to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. I live on the border between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And Ciudad Juarez in the 90s had uncovering hundreds and hundreds of murdered women. They were buried in all over the city. And it was just this horrible, horrible death and violence. And then in the 2000s, the drug wars came to Ciudad Juarez. And it became the most dangerous city in the world. And what ended up happening during this time is a lot of writers began to write about Ciudad Juarez. And frankly, a lot of them superficially try to describe the landscape. But then you would have people like Bolaño, who wrote 2666. And even though he wasn't from Juarez, because I don't think that's a requirement, he wrote Juarez in, you know, just an incredibly vivid and powerful way. And I was wondering if you have ever read Bolaño or ever read that book, because I think what you're doing to Detroit, and not very many people can do this, because a lot of people would just be superficial. There'd be this superficial desolation, right. You know, this kind of comic noir type of thing. Have you read Bolaño?
I've read The Savage Detectives. It's the only thing of his I've read. I've read that when it first came out in English. I have 2666, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, well,
but maybe I should too. Yeah.
Well, you do to Detroit what Bolaño does to Ciudad Juarez, because I don't, you know, I think a lot of writers couldn't pull off what you did. So congratulations on giving us this incredibly powerful, powerful landscape.
I mean, I think there are a couple things really about that. I think one is that despite being from Michigan, I'm not from Detroit, although, you know, I spent a fair bit of time there, but not in a way that makes me feel like I have sort of like ownership over the landscape, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it was important to me that to write a book from the perspective of a character who's an outsider. And also, some of the book's stance on it is this, like, heightened, exaggerated, sort of mythic version of Detroit.
Right,
and part
right.
of the reason for that was that I think, it, you know, it's a book set in Detroit, and it is about Detroit in some ways, but I also, Detroit's already a city that a lot of outsiders have imposed their narratives on, right?
Right.
And I wanted to be at least self-critical about that, even if I was still doing it. And I think that made me careful in certain ways. You know, I read a lot about the city. I studied a lot of photographs. I went there and spent some time with a photographer who does a lot of documentation of the scrapping. I tried to do my due diligence, you know. And at the same time, you know, novels are obviously works of imagination,
right.
And they get translated through yourself and your story and your character. But yeah, I think that it would have, I really, really, really worried about doing like an uncareful job or a glib job or writing a book that didn't acknowledge also that this is not the only story of Detroit. I think there's obviously lots of great things happening in Detroit and great communities there. And some of Kelly's problem is that he doesn't access those when he meets them or he doesn't join them. And I wanted that to sort of also be part of the book's landscape, that you would at least see it in his peripheral vision, other lives he could be leading if he was psychologically able, I think.
You know, that's interesting. I had never thought about what you said, that you wrote it from the perspective of an outsider. And perhaps that really is one of the things that lends so much authenticity to the landscape, that,
mm-hmm.
that he is new to it, as opposed to trying to speak authoritatively about it. And then the other...
Yeah, I think it would be a failure in some ways for me to try to write from that a person who lives in this neighborhood for 50 years is not, I'm not capable of, really. It's not my story to tell.
Also, the fact that you're writing about the zone, and the
right.
zone is unoccupied, so the zone doesn't really have any denizens other than the, you know, those other scrappers that are going through, or
right.
or these ghosts, or those who really don't have much of a voice,
mm-hmm.
because they're hidden, and you know they're
right.
they're underneath everything. But also, I love the zone, this desolate part, because when you're in the zone, you are completely connected to the source. You know, it's like
right.
you know, writers say, oh, I was really in the zone. And I imagine that as you were writing this, at least this is my imagination, and maybe it's not true, but that there were probably some moments when you really found yourself falling into the zone and into that landscape. Was that a difficult process sometimes?
Yeah, I think, I mean, every book has its sort of, has its emotional difficulties and stuff, but I think for whatever reason, this book was harder on me to write than other things I've written. And some of it was, I think, the subject matter is so heavy, and the mood of the book is pretty bleak in different ways. But I think Kelly's such a lonely character, and he's in such a lonely place, and it was hard to inhabit that all the time. But I think that's okay. I mean, I think that hopefully that's part of the book's authenticity and honesty, too, is that you're willing to put yourself through it as a writer. But it's an interesting thing to, I mean, I don't know how your writing process is, but for me, I write in the mornings as soon as I get up, and I tend
right.
to do it before I interact with the other people a lot. And it was a real joy sometimes to come out of this book at noon and go out into the world and be with people and people I cared about and people I interacted with positively. But it also made that difference, made it really obvious sometimes to see what Kelly didn't have,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that I could go back to the next day and come back into this character who had a lack that I do not, but understand and have had other times, right?
Yeah, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I too write in the daytime, and to work on it all morning, to be in the zone, both literally and figuratively,
uh-huh.
and then to go outside, I would imagine no matter where you are, the sun is shining and birds are chirping, and it's an entirely different world.
Yeah, and you know, and there's always these kind of funny things about like where you end up writing books, you know, where I started this book when I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was, you know, 45 minutes away from the place I'm writing about. I wrote most of it living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in a much more sort of rural environment. And then I did the last draft here in Phoenix, you know, where you're writing this very wintry, urban, Midwestern last draft while, you know, walking outside into, like, endless sunshine every day. And the way that, in some ways, that makes it easier to do, right? Like, the imaginative space is kind of unpolluted by the life around it because it's not the same thing.
Yeah. We're talking to Matt Bell, whose new novel, Scrapper, just came out with Soho Press. You know, in El Paso, Cormac McCarthy used to live really just like about a mile away from where I'm sitting right now. Mm-hmm. And his house in this neighborhood by the university, these old houses, was on, check this out, Coffin Street. I kid you not, Coffin Street.
Sure.
I pass by it all the time because I lived in the same neighborhood. And this is around the time he was writing his, you know, stuff like Blood Meridian. The house looks so dark. At the time when I was reading Blood Meridian, I entered into that landscape so thoroughly that I found myself going crazy and had to leave occasionally. And I thought of him inside that house writing that novel and what he must have been experiencing every morning and how coming out for the day, because he would walk around all, you know, all around the neighborhood. He would walk to Barnes & Noble. Kind of what I'm imagining with Matt Bell, to make another comparison to McCarthy, because this landscape and this character, Kelly, he's kind of running away from his life. He's a boxer. He pushes his physicality to the limits. I mean, he just, what he puts on his body, you know, the training that he goes through, the punches that he takes. Tell us how this guy came about and how you said he was born of the landscape. Can you elaborate on that? Just tell us a little bit more about how this guy came about.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know much about his past when I started out. I'm not much of a planner. I sort of just get working and see what happens. And early on, in the very earliest days of working in the book, I didn't even know his name. You know, I had this right. character. I sort of, I think in early draft, that earliest writing was maybe the first month or so he didn't have a name. And it was just like the Scrapper, you know. And my whole goal was just like just to keep him moving, just to keep him in the landscape, just to keep him doing things. And you know, when you're writing books in third person, but it's so close to him, and you know, it's his sensibility that's inflecting the language and the way of seeing what we're seeing, and the details. And you just start to get to know a person by like what they notice when they walk into a room, right? What they notice in their space, what they feel when they're somewhere. And so much of it's generated that way. And we haven't talked about this yet, but, you know, it's the kind of inciting incident, the plot of the book, is that he finds this young boy who's been kidnapped in one of the houses that he's scrapping for metal. And I didn't know that was going to happen, like, until it happened when I was writing. And as soon as that happened, and as soon as I started writing that experience, it started to suggest what that might mean for Kelly, what that might, to be a person who rescues this, who's completely alone in this landscape, and then saves another human life, both suggested a future for him, what he might want to do because of that. But also, I think, like, a lot of his past backed out from that. You know, you're always looking in fiction, right, for, like, the most fraught, the most emotionally loaded version of something. And it was like, if this was the thing that set his future in motion, what path would be best for that or most powerfully moved by that? And so in a weird way, like, him finding Daniel, the boy that he rescued, generated his future and his past in both directions for me in a really powerful way.
The sentence that captures Kelly for me is that he didn't believe in luck. He believed in bananas.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, he's an incredibly complex character. And yeah, I'm surprised that you didn't know he was going to find Daniel. I remember when I got my MFA at the University of Oregon, fiction writing, and I remember one of my professors, he said, the great novelist has the entire novel in the first sentence. It's more complex than that. In the very first sentence, you tell us that when Kelly saved the boy, he was not yet again living any real life, which really does kind of capture it. So I imagine once you found out, you went back and revised a bit.
Yeah, I think I wrote that first sentence very, very late. Although I think a lot of the rest of that beginning was like the first stuff I wrote. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons for me is, like, I do like that idea of a first sentence containing a lot of what's to come.
Right.
But I rarely know it in the beginning. I think that one of the reasons to go back and put the boy in that first sentence was because it takes the book a little while to get to him.
Yeah,
and I knew that the reader might need a promise a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Like, this really big plot thing is coming. And then I wanted that careful landscape at the beginning. I just had to have the reader see Kelly in isolation before I saw him with other people, you know, that. But I really like that idea that the book is in that. And I think that's probably true to some extent.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's definitely true for this novel. It made me trust you right away. Immediately.
Good.
And I knew I was going to come back. And I think it took, I don't know, many, many pages and chapters before it come back to that. But you always knew that it was going somewhere. And that's,
right. That
generates trust with the reader immediately. We're running out of time, but I have just one more really quick question. There are three other settings in this book. One is in Guantanamo Bay. The other one is Sanford, Florida. And then one in the Ukraine with different characters. The Florida character, I'm assuming, is...
Based on George Zimmerman, yes.
Oh, yes, George Zimmerman. When I read the part about Guantanamo Bay, I'm thinking, because I trust you completely, and
right.
I'm thinking, okay, this is going to connect. And then when I read the Sanford one, I started to think, okay, this is thematic. And then by the time I got to the Ukraine, that kind of made me think, okay, as a reader, you know, I'm put in a position to make the connection, to make the thematic connection.
Yeah.
Let me ask you what was going on when you decided, or was it a choice? Was it just an organic urge? How did these parts, which really never interact with the narrative through line, how they came about?
Sure. Maybe I first want to say that one of the things I like about them not interacting directly and having that thematic link instead is I really think, like, this is a book that definitely has an argument to it about a couple of things, about the cycles of fear and violence, about whether redemption through violence is possible, these kind of things, which, you know, I think my personal aspect is like, no, that's a bad story we tell ourselves. And, I mean, I think it's one of the most harmful stories we tell culturally. Anyway, not to go down that road too hard. But you can make an argument really directly at a reader, or you can give them the pieces and ask them to do the logic. And my feeling is that when you directly say, this is how the world is to a reader, the reader accepts or rejects that premise. And either way, it's not theirs. If you let the logic happen in the reader of the emotion or the morality or the intellectual ideas of your story, whatever they form, they own, and it's theirs, and they believe it.
Right,
and so while I could have drawn the lines more directly between those pieces, I think the more powerful impact for the reader is not. As far as how they came about, One of the things about Kelly is that his perspective is very limited. He has sort of a tunnel vision. And I knew that the things I was writing about, I mean, the reason to write the book in some ways, the things I was interested in were bigger than this one person's story. They're not specific to Detroit. I think they're found everywhere, from the personal to the political to the environmental. And I wanted ways to widen those out. Kelly, by nature, has a limited perspective, but that doesn't mean the book has to have one. And it's a gamble. I think they're going to come up in every review.
I bet.
Every interview.
I imagine.
They're very divisive. But okay, I think I'd rather take a gamble and hope that I think the person could skip those three and just read Kelly's story, and I wouldn't be mad about how they read my book. I hope there's something offered by them.
Well, I do appreciate how it was really up to the reader to make the connection, and also it was a way to get us out of the zone for a little while. So I think it's a successful part of the book. And Matt Bell, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. It's a fantastic book. We wish you the best of luck.
Thanks so much, Daniel. It was really nice talking to you.